Yeah, so we'll open the floor now for questions. So please, I would like to welcome questions rather than statements. We'd like to learn from Jeff as much as possible. If we run out of questions, then if we have time, we'll have some statements. So questions for Jeff, please.
I would like to ask, when you're doing the right thing, I utterly approve of everything you have done in Israel, everything you're doing here now. But I took part in an occupation of two universities here in Sheffield last spring, and we were thrown out. The police were called in. The authorities tried to actually arrest me. I'm a student at one of these institutions, and other students who tried to flee to protest about what was happening in Gaza. Now, the people who threw us out were supported by the Students' Union, and the Students' Union was dominated by the Labour Party. You're going to go inside that Labour Party and talk to them. Now, I'm not saying don't do that. But I would like these people who support you here to be outside that Labour Party protesting about what that new Labour Party is doing. Because all the main political parties, when it boils down to it, are following United States domination, United States imperial policy, and supporting the Israelis. And that is the fact. We have to build a protest movement outside. We have to start demonstrating occupation. So my question is, will you be outside? Will the campaign here be outside as well as inside?
Well, I'll take that more as a suggestion to the local PSC chapters and to the groups here to do that, because I think it's very important. I'll be outside, and I'll also be inside. We're in a bad marriage. What can we do? We need governments. Not necessarily. You can have an anarchist position, which is fine. But at least the way things are structured today, we need governments. We can't negotiate. We can't sign treaties. We don't have that authority that governments have. And we need them. The problem is, of course, and we all know this, that governments will not do the right thing, period. I mean, they have a history of not doing the right thing on any issue. And they have to be pushed by the people. And that's certainly the lesson of apartheid South Africa and many other struggles, and it's true here. So I try to engage with political figures. They're not all bad people. They're not especially... I'm not going to get into that. But some of them aren't especially brave people. But what can you do? You've got to kind of chip away. And we have allies within the different parties. But you're absolutely right. Unless people are outside, unless these politicians feel that this is an issue that their constituents care about, that there's a certain shift in public opinion that I believe there is in Britain and elsewhere, they're not going to do anything. So that we've got to try to develop a strategy of both engagement, because we need them. So we have to engage with them, we have to persuade them, we have to be sure, we have to monitor what they're doing and so on and push them. But at the same time, confrontation, because they're not going to do that unless we really do push them. And governments don't work with civil society. They don't like civil society very much. They work government to government. So we have to forcibly almost insert ourselves into the political process. So certainly your comments are very well taken, and that is something that should be done, certainly.
Some of the Israeli politicians who are talking about supporting a two-state solution use the expression two states for two peoples. And at the same time, there's more and more talk about loyalty oaths for Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. Is the underlying intention to move existing Israeli citizens out of Israel into the Bantustans?
You know, Israel doesn't have a master plan. It has a master vision. In other words, it knows where it would like to go. Israel would like this entire, even a Bantustan is a compromise. You know, Netanyahu, who's now the prime minister, is even against the Bantustan. He says the Bantustan is too much for the Palestinians. Why should we give, or he doesn't say Palestinians, he says Arabs. We don't use the word Palestinians in Israel. We talk about Arabs because we don't recognize that collectivity, that people that are Palestinians. So Netanyahu says, why should we give 15% of our country to Arabs? You know, let them go. So there's a master vision that is articulated. It's not a hidden agenda in any way. And certainly the Arab citizens of Israel are considered a fifth column. They're not really considered Israelis. You just, again, have to look at the flag and you can see that. So that, but I mean, there's no master plan of driving the Palestinians out. But what Israel certainly does is it has this, it has plans in the drawer. So when the opportunities arise, it can pull them out. It's ready. It, for example, when the war in Lebanon began in 2006, we organized, both Israelis and Palestinians organized, because we really feared that under the guise of that war, and we did the same thing in 2003 when the United States invaded Iraq, the same thing, that under everybody's attention is deflected elsewhere, Israel will in fact enact another step in the ethnic cleansing and drive the Palestinians out. In other words, that possibility is there. Like I said, it's still, even in this world, it's still very hard for Israel to load 4 million Palestinians on trucks and ship them to Jordan. I mean, it's still not really doable. We call it the transfer, and it's not. It's only a problem logistically in Israel. It's not a problem morally or politically in any way. Lieberman, of course, who's our foreign minister, talks. That's one of the main platforms of his political party's program is transfer. I mean, it's very upfront. So that it seems to me that even though Israel would like to drive Palestinians out, it's going to settle for a Bantustan. And that, and in a sense, you might look at the Palestinians inside Israel as a part of that Bantustan. You know, the Palestinians are 20% of the Israeli population, and yet by law, they're limited to 3.5% of the land of the country. By law, non-Jews, which of course includes the Palestinians, are forbidden to live on 94% of the land of Israel, which is considered state land and land that's held in custody for the entire Jewish people. So that this apartheid thing, what's proper to say is it's true, we can't really differentiate the occupied territories from Israel itself in terms of Palestinian rights. And this is something that we really have to be, I think, on top of. So this is, now what Israel is doing, just one more word, is that in the meantime, it is pursuing a kind of a transfer. It's what we call the quiet transfer. And that is that through house demolitions, through economic constraints, so that the Palestinians become impoverished. You know, 70% of the Palestinians live on less than a pound and a half a day. Restrictions on education and on jobs and everything else, what Israel is doing is driving the middle classes, the Palestinian middle classes, out of the country. In other words, in a way, Israel doesn't have to drive all the Palestinians out. If it can drive out the middle classes, who are the more educated, the more economically active, the community leaders out, it's very easy to then manipulate and control the masses. So that is a process, and it's estimated, we don't know for sure, that something like 300,000 Palestinians have indeed left the occupied territories, have left the country altogether in the last 8 or 9 years. So that policy is working, and I think it's a very important part of the whole equation to keep in mind.
Please. Can I have the gentleman behind them who was mentioned?
How do you see this movement in Palestine towards the struggle for one state, given how much energy there is behind kind of the idea of a Palestinian state, and particularly with regard to the PA, which is obviously predicated on this two-state solution, right? How do we turn that around?
First of all, we're an Israeli organization, so we don't take a position in terms of the solution. We say this is the Palestinians' prerogative. I'm not a Palestinian. I can't say one state, two states, 10 states. I have to give my support to the Palestinian struggle, and in a sense, they have to define where they're going. And it's a real issue for the Palestinians today, as we know. That's one of the things that makes the struggle difficult. In South Africa, the ANC had one unified goal. It was called, in those days, one man, one vote. They might change the phrasing today, but that's what it was in those days. With the Palestinians, of course, you have a lot of different approaches, from one state of Hamas to a one-state approach of the Palestinian diaspora more, to a two-state approach or regional confederation. And that makes it difficult for us. Essentially, I think maybe Mushir and others should answer this. I feel personally that there's a split, that the diaspora, the Palestinian diaspora, has moved much more strongly towards a one-state solution in the last numbers of years. Whereas the Palestinians in Palestine are still holding on, sort of with their fingernails, to this two-state solution. I think, assuming, or from the point of view that this is the solution that at least is accepted by the international community. It's on the table. You have a roadmap. Obama's talking about it. And it's taken 50 years to get the two-state solution on the table, and the fear is, of course, that if we now jump to a one-state solution, that's unacceptable to Israel, obviously, but would probably be unacceptable to the international community at this stage, that we're putting everything back for another 50 years. Nevertheless, more and more, obviously, both Palestinians and Israelis and others are beginning to see that the two-state solution, unless it's apartheid, which is not acceptable, a real two-state solution is highly unlikely. Now, we're waiting on Obama. That's the problem. Over all these years, there was never a point where you could cut it and say, okay, the two-state solution is over, now let's go to another, because they were always dangling something else in front of you. It was Oslo, and then there was the Geneva Initiative, and there's the Mitchell Report, and there's the roadmap, and there's Annapolis. And now there's some mystical Obama regional peace plan that they were promising for the end of September. Yesterday in the Israeli press, it was reported that Mitchell said there is no Obama peace plan. So where do you cut it? Where do you say, all right, this political option is gone. It doesn't have the support, or the international community is not assertive enough on Israel to make it happen. We have to move to another option. It's hard to say. I think it's going to happen in the next couple of months. I think we're going to see whether Obama presents a peace plan or not. I think it's going to be clear that either he's going to have that assertive policy, and he started out well, but he's lost a lot of that momentum. He's either going to be assertive enough, and he has to be assertive, to get a two-state solution back on the table, or else I think most Palestinians and most people that support the Palestinian cause are going to really start moving towards a one-state solution.
You speak a lot about Israel years ago, the invention of that. You're an Israeli, I'm an Israeli. What do you think from the Israeli side, instead of the Palestinian side, what do most Israelis really want in terms of, I mean, Israeli citizens, people who live like you and me, I live here, my friends and many people are doing lots of peace work like yourself, and we are trying to make sense of this mess. What do Israelis really want?
No, that's a really good question, and in a way, there's hope in this, because I don't think Israelis know what they want. I mean, there isn't a clear... what the good news is that I think the vast majority of Israeli Jews, and I would say 80% of Israeli Jews even, never bought into the occupation. They never bought into this idea of a greater land of Israel. They never bought into the settlements. For example, the ideological settlers, the ones that we think of when we talk about settlers, the religious people living in these settlements that are violent towards Palestinians and the people they got out of Gaza, they're only about 15% of the settler population. The 85% of the Israelis that live in the occupied territories live there for economic reasons. They're either working class people that have been given cheap but very high quality and affordable housing. This is where Israel has built around Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. Or they're young couples that got married that couldn't afford housing inside Israel. They're not there for ideological reasons. So if you replicated Male Adumim inside Israel, they would have no trouble moving back. So that 15% in the West Bank, so you're talking about 15% of about, let's say, 250,000 Israeli settlers, which is, in my quick mathematics, what is that, 30, 35,000 people. In other words, you're talking, let's say, about 30, 35,000 ideologically committed settlers out of a Jewish population of 5.5 million. And this is after 42 years. That's why they're building outposts. What are outposts? You get a community of 2,000 people that splits off and 20 go and they set up an outpost somewhere, and another 5 go and do another outpost. In other words, it's not a growing population, and it doesn't represent a very significant... Now, they have political clout. You know, even Netanyahu, who's the prime minister, supports them. Their political clout is disproportional to their actual size. But the Israeli public has never really bought into that. But at the same time, so the Israeli public would not, I don't think, would not in any way, I think the Israeli public wants a two-state solution. They don't want peace in the sense that we're using it, of reconciliation, of neighborly relations, of people living together. Israelis want the wall. They want separation. It's not a good vision of peace, but Israelis would just like to cut this albatross off their neck and get on with their lives. That's the way it is. So that, but at the same time, Israelis are living very well. You know, the government has succeeded in creating a bubble that insulates them from the occupation. You know, terrorism or attacks or whatever you want to call it have been reduced to a minimum. Israelis are feeling personally very secure. The economy is doing great. You know, the shekel is today one of the 15 strongest currencies in the world. Tourism is back. Despite certain dents we've gotten because of Gaza, Israel's status in Europe improves all the time. It's still close that we don't know about Obama yet. But in other words, Israelis are feeling very secure. And this is what I'm trying to say. It's very hard to convey this. The occupation is not an issue in Israel. It's a non-issue. And that's what makes it so hard. You can't engage with Israelis. That's why I'm in Sheffield when I'm not in Jerusalem tonight. You know, and it's like, I make this really short. It's like, I do an analogy that's kind of cute tonight. In my dating days, I don't know how it is in Britain, but
it's a long time ago.
You know, if you went out with a girl, a young woman, And she said, "I hate you." Okay, I can deal with that. I can work with that. There's an emotion there. Once she said, "Let's just be friends," you went home. I mean, there's nowhere to go from there. That's I think, a very good analogy for what's happening in Israel. If I would hear Israeli Jews say, "We hate those Arabs," okay, there's a feeling there. There's a relationship. The Arabs mean something. You could work, but Israelis just don't care. They don't think about Arabs, and I'm using the word Arabs on purpose and not Palestinians. They don't. We had our electoral campaign when Netanyahu got into power 2 weeks after Israel invaded, you know, after Israel left Gaza during that invasion. The word Gaza was not mentioned, I think, once in the electoral campaign. It wasn't an issue. The occupation wasn't an issue. Peace certainly wasn't an issue. Everybody talks about security, but everybody agrees on that. They talked about, is Tzipi Livni better than Netanyahu? What about the latest scandal, the economy, religious, secular issues? So that this has been reduced, the occupation, I think, in Israel, has been reduced to a non-issue. And it's out of sight, out of mind, nobody cares. And that's why I say that peace is not going to come from inside Israel, simply because Israelis don't care. They could live in this situation forever. They're living very well. But if Obama or the international community came in and imposed a peace and said, you know, the occupation is over, period, I think the vast majority of Israeli Jews would welcome that. That's exactly what they want. They want to get rid of this damn occupation and get on with their lives. They can't do it themselves. They're living okay with it, so it's not very urgent for them. But nevertheless, they would not be an obstacle to peace. But it has to come from the outside. That's the problem we're facing.
It seems to be primarily the United States military and financial support which gives legitimacy to what Israel is doing and has been doing. Do you think
Europe plays its role?
And Europe, of course, Europe, but primarily the United States gives that military, financial support and legitimacy. Do you think the Obama administration is going to withdraw that support, and if you think it's not going to withdraw that financial and military support, why do you think that is?
That's the big imponderable. That, you know, Kissinger, our friend Henry Kissinger, used to say that countries don't have foreign policies. They have domestic policies. So I think Obama gets it. I mean, at least you have an intelligent president for a change. So that's already something. And he gets it. He has said himself, and Rahm Emanuel has said, that there's a linkage. And that's something that Israel has always denied. There's a linkage between this conflict and Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Al-Qaeda. You know, James Baker, who was Bush the father's Secretary of State, called this the epicenter of instability in the entire Muslim world. It's clear that this is the symbolic heart of that alienation between the Muslim world and the West. And Rahm Emanuel, who's very central to this whole thing, has said several times that we're not going to be able to address the issue of Iran until we address the Palestine issue. This is a precondition for bringing stabilization and addressing these issues. So I think they get it. I think they understand that. And I think Obama came into a world where the United States is in a very different position. It's militarily overextended in the Middle East, economically weakened, politically isolated, and so on. Okay. And he has said the magic words. This is where I take some hope. In the American language, in the code of the United States, when the president, in his role as commander-in-chief, which is a bigger thing than being the president, says, Resolving this conflict is in the vital national interests of the United States. Whoa, that puts the whole thing on an entirely different level. You know, when the president says that, and presidents don't say that very often, because you can't overdo that hand, Congress sits up. And AIPAC and the Jewish lobby and Israel back down. Because I want to tell you, and it's probably true of Jews here too, Jews in the United States are 150% American. I mean, there is absolutely no question that if it gets to a place where American interests are in conflict with support for Israel, they're in the American camp instantly. You don't even have to think about it. And actually, we saw AIPAC backing down during that time. So he raised the bar. He did it very well. And that carried through the Cairo speech. For some reason that I don't know, he stopped at Cairo. From Cairo until today, they got back into this haggling with Israel. You know, so they said settlement freeze. Not only did Israel say no, but Israel declared it's building more housing units. And more. Israel says we're building an entire new city called Maskiot here on the Jordan River. So Israel, see, this is the contest. Israel is saying, you're going to raise the bar? We're going to raise the bar. You know? We're going to build settlements. We're going to demolish houses. When Hillary Clinton is in Jerusalem, we're going to demolish houses. What are you going to do about it? You see? And no, but that's the point. They're testing. Because if they say that and the Obama administration reacts in a major way, but if they react weakly, then you know that it's all... So they demolished a whole slew of houses in Jerusalem when Hillary Clinton was there. And she said in Ramallah, it was unhelpful. And so for Israel, that's the green light. So that's what I don't know what's going on. Why Obama's back down. Now with the settlement freeze, it might be a partial freeze. It might be for 9 months. It might not include Jerusalem. I mean, if the United States can't impose a settlement freeze, then how in the hell is it going to get Israel out of the occupied territories? I mean, that's the problem. One of the problems might be, I'll just say, the domestic area. You know, the Democratic Party, Obama's own party, has always been much more pro-Israel than the Republicans. 80% of the Jews vote Democratic. That and for other reasons. So that when I was in Washington, I was told that Obama's going to have more trouble with Nancy Pelosi, who is the Democratic Speaker of the House, than he's going to have with Netanyahu. So I could see a scenario in which Obama and Mitchell say, we're going to go this way for American interests, and the Democrats in Congress are going to say, no, we're not. We want to get elected in a year and a half. So the real question for me in this whole thing is, can he take control of his own party in order to be assertive enough? Because you can't haggle with Israel, and you can't cuddle Israel. You've got to be tough on Israel, really, because it's not going to do anything to help voluntarily. And that, and now with the healthcare issue, where Obama has really been weakened and hasn't done too well, that, in terms of the domestic politics, could really affect his ability now to go on to another major issue. So I think that's sort of the imponderable here. I think he gets it, which is good. He sees this is in the American interest, which is good. But the question is, that's really the question. Is he going to be assertive enough on Israel? And so far, there's no indication. Now, what they could do is easy. I mean, they've been hinting, for example, if the United States would simply withdraw its automatic veto from the Security Council on issues relating to Israel. That would be... But I'll tell you something even more. I'll stop on this. I see Moshe wiggling in his seat. Israel, I'm writing a whole book about this. I'm not going to get into it, but Israel is very involved. Its economy is based on its involvement in the global arms trade, weapons developments, which is doing with Britain as well, and so on. And that's largely based on its privileged access to American military technology. So, you know, Intel, for example, which is all military, it's not your, just your PC, its research and development centers are the Silicon Valley, Ireland, and Israel. So if Obama would whisper in the ear of the Secretary of Defense, Israel does not have any more privileged access to our military technology. I think that alone would do it. I mean, the Israeli economy would collapse if that happened. So there are very subtle and very pointed things that the United States can do, or even hint at doing, that would move things ahead. But I find in Obama a real flaw, and that is that he has a pattern. It's nice to reach out bipartisan and to be inclusive and to try to talk to all the parties and bring them together. But that can also paralyze you, because if one of the parties like Israel is not acting in good faith and really isn't part of the circle and cooperating, you end up paralyzing yourself. At some point, you've got to stand up and be assertive. And he's not very good at that. So I'm saying all this because I don't know. But I think this relates to exactly to your question. All right. I need 2 minutes at the end for something else that I want to do.
Absolutely. I just will take one more question, then have the 2 minutes, because I'm just conscious of... I'd like to give a chance to people who want to buy Jeff's book and have him signing it. So we'll take 2 questions, and then we'll have the 2 minutes, and then my hour of closing of the meeting. So can we have you then Wendy, and that's.
What actions can Palestinians take in a proactive way to move this thing forward, right?
What actions should Israelis take? Because I'm going to be there next week and I want to say to my relatives who live there, what action are you taking?
They're not going to take action. I mean, they can...
If I can't take action,
I know.
More people join ICAP.
Right. Okay, we can talk about that. In terms of the Palestinians, you know, and this is something that we all know, the Palestinians, look, there's always been a real distance or alienation between the political leadership and the people. I mean, less so during Arafat's time, but still very much so. Arafat at one point wanted to close all the Palestinian NGOs. I mean, it's a pattern that's similar to many third world countries. Leadership that's kind of disconnected from the grassroots. So that what happens, with the Palestinians, is that the Palestinian leadership has a monopoly over the messages going out, over who's saying them. And it's not the Palestinians, you know, I think world public opinion has moved very strongly towards the Palestinian cause, despite the Palestinian Authority. Because you've got really articulate Palestinians, including some guy up on the stage with me here, that could be used by the Palestinian Authority to be spokespeople. They could be on the news, they could be in the newspapers, they're very articulate, they're writing, and instead they're stifled. You know, Hanan Ashrawi, who is one of the most articulate spoke, isn't speaking anymore. She's sitting at home because she feels this sense of alienation, of hostility towards her. She's not allowed to say what she wants to say. And I think this is a real problem. I think this is where I'm going beyond what I should say, because I'm not a Palestinian. I can't tell the Palestinians what to do. But I think this is where the Palestinian diaspora should step in and have a real tough meeting with the Palestinian leadership and say, we want a larger role for the Palestinian civil society. We want to hear their voices more. We want them out in the media more. We want them to come out. And that the Palestinian diaspora itself should be more assertive. But I think that's a huge problem, because the Palestinians have justice on their side. They've got a tremendous case to articulate. They have the people that can do it. And those voices are being stifled. And I'll just tell you one other thing real quickly. You know Afif. You know Afif Safiya. I mean, he was here for years. He left Britain and went to the United States to be the Palestinian representative. And then he moved to Moscow. Last July, he moved to Moscow. The Palestinian Authority just appointed a representative in Washington, who's not a very great representative, but that's something else. In other words, for the last year, with the whole Obama administration coming into office, there has not been a Palestinian representative in Washington, D.C. So in some ways, the Palestinian Authority has taken itself almost out of the political game. It's something I have trouble explaining, but I think that there really is legitimate criticism here, and the Palestinian community should deal with that, I think. Because we're limited. I mean, we're Israelis. We're really limited. But many of you, most of you, aren't Palestinians. We can support the Palestinians, and we can speak out and everything, but we can't take that last step. I can't represent the Palestinians. If you ask me what's the solution, I can't tell you this is a solution, because I'm not a Palestinian. So without that strong Palestinian voice to lead us, we're kind of stuck. And I think that's a real issue.
The last question.
I just wanted to ask something about you.
Well, I think you need more energy than courage. It's tiring. It wears you down. I got to admit. You know, there's an American saying or phrase. It's called the long haul, H-A-U-L. That people have written about and so on. And that is, I think, if you break off or take for yourself a significant chunk of social justice, you know, whether, you know, some major issue, you know that you're fighting huge, powerful cultural forces, political forces, economic forces, and so on. So that, you know, this is a big thing, this conflict, but a lot of other things that we're all engaged in. And so you know that, you know what, you might not see the outcome in your lifetime. You know, but you're chipping away at it. You know what you're doing is contributing. You have an analysis. You're going at it. Hopefully you'll live to see it. I mean, Arafat didn't live to see it. But that doesn't mean that he didn't dedicate his life to that. And you're in for the long haul. And what makes people burn out is when they think that they can get into this with all their efforts, and in a year or two or 3 years, it's going to be resolved. And then 3 years go by, and 5 years go by, and 20 years go by, and the problem's worse. I mean, when I started 12 years ago as the head of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, 9,000 houses had been demolished. In the 30 years, between 1967 and 1997, when we started, 9,000 houses have been demolished in the occupied territories. From 1997 until today, another 15,000 houses have been demolished. So if I'm looking at, am I being effective? I mean, I you could blame me for the increase in house demolition. If I was a CEO, I'd be fired. But you see the long term. You see what you're doing. You see the gains. You see the fact that you're in Sheffield and this many people came out and people are active and we're working together. That's what sustains you, I think, is that long-term idea and that analysis. And it's not easy, but you understand that that's the struggle you're in, and I think that keeps you going.
I'd like on behalf of you all to thank Jeff Halper for this exceptional evening, for the hope he brought with us. I think the words you said, Jeff, are extremely important. We can't afford for imminent, immediate success. We have to work long-term, and we are working long-term. With people like Jeff, I, as a Palestinian, feel that there is hope for us to live together. We must be human beings, as Jeff is. To Jeff and ICAD and all the workers for peace and justice, I just say thank you very much on behalf of people in Sheffield. Thank you very much.